When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here! Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This podcast is brought to you by Purposefully Different Productions and is proudly sponsored by Little Dish, makers of delicious fresh meals for kids that are an absolute lifesaver on busy days. I love these meals because they are different to other kids' meals out there. They include a variety of ingredients, lots of textures, and are made with little taste buds in mind. Before we get started on today's episode, here's a word from our friend Giovanna Fletcher.
At Little Dish, we've spent years perfecting delicious, healthy, fresh meals guaranteed to be eaten by kids. Except when you sprinkle cheese on top instead of letting them do it, or if the Little Dish is served on the red plate or the yellow plate or the blue plate, or when you talk over them, or when they can't wear their Ranger antlers because it's summer and they're in the loft, or on Mondays or on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and potentially even Sundays. Good luck and Godspeed. Little Dish. Healthy food kids love. Find us in the chilled aisle.
Hello and welcome back to How to Feed with me, Charlotte Sterling-Reed, the parenting podcast that brings you reassurance, confidence and practical advice on feeding your baby, toddler and the whole family. Today's episode, we're diving into allergies, something I know is such a huge subject for so many parents. We'll discuss how to introduce solids in a way that may reduce the risk of allergies developing. We'll discuss how to maintain tolerance once allergens have actually been introduced and, of course, what to do if a reaction actually happens. We'll also explore living with allergies, practical tips for families, and the fascinating world of immunotherapy. And honestly, I couldn't be more excited to be joined today by the brilliant Dr. Helen Evan-Howes, a GP and allergy specialist with over 15 years of experience supporting families through the often very confusing and emotional world of allergies. Helen is a mum herself who has had to navigate allergies firsthand, so she brings not only her clinical expertise but her real-life empathy to the conversation too. So whether you're starting weaning or whether you're already managing allergies with your little one, this episode is packed full of practical advice, reassurance and lots of expert insight. Thank you so much for coming on, Helen. So Helen, can you tell us a little bit about what you do day to day, what your job is and your background?
Yeah, sure. So, I am primarily a GP and trained as a GP, although these days I do very much GP work anymore. I mainly do allergy.
Okay.
And like many people, the reason that I became interested in that is because of our own experiences with our children. So my first son, Ethan, who's 16 now, had milk and nut allergies and eczema and environmental allergies and asthma. He's got the whole cohort, bless him. And when he was little, we kind of went through this journey of just not realizing or not expecting for him to have allergies. So he was on intensive care and then he developed the classic non-IgE symptoms. So reflux, unhappy, eczema, diarrhea, grunty. And he was my first. And even though I was a doctor, I just kind of thought, well, that's how it is. Mentioned it to his neonatologist who said, well, cut milk out of your breastfeeding diet. So I did, without really thinking about what that meant. And he got better. But funnily enough, looking back, I attributed it to when we went on holiday and I was like, oh, it must be the change of season. And tried another holiday with my second daughter at the same time. Did not work. And anyway, his dad was like, oh, I just don't think he's got an allergy. So at weaning, I was like, okay, well, I'll just give him cow's milk. So I gave him cheese and he promptly swelled up, vomited, hives.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And it is crazy now because you kind of, I've seen that reaction so often that I'm more deconditioned to it, I guess. But at the time, it was terrifying.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh. So I rang his dad and he was like, well, call an ambulance if it's that bad. And I was like, oh, I don't really know if it's that bad.
Yeah, it's
so, you know, because I think being, you know, even though I was a GP trainee at the time, so I had been qualified as a doctor for many, well, about, I don't know, 5 years or something. The training within allergy is really limited even now. So even though
as
I trained
a GP, as a,
well, no, as a doctor full stop or any health professional. So even though I was at Southampton University, which has got a phenomenal allergy degree because I've since been back and done it, we had one day. And so if you were sick, you've missed everything to do with allergy, which is staggering given, you know, a third of the population have environmental allergies. 5 to 6% of children have food allergies, 1 to 2% of adults. So it's absolutely ridiculous that we don't have more baseline understanding. So my natural thoughts, as I think every sort of layperson's thoughts would be, he's going to die. And, you know, I rushed him off to the chemist with this baby sort of feeding him Pyroton in the park and he got better. But therein followed this journey of sort of trying to find our way through allergy, making lots of mistakes along the way, like giving him goat's milk because I thought that would be a good alternative. And would go along to his consultant's appointments and he'd always be like, well, why did you do that? And I was like, well, I thought it was a good idea to give him goat's milk.
I
didn't know. And I think there was an assumption that I would know how to read packets, that cow's milk is similar to other animal milks, what anaphylaxis looks like, lots of things like that, that actually we don't know. And that's why often when you're going to your GP or health visitor or even into A&E, you are getting poor information because we don't know those basics. So when he had anaphylaxis that I didn't recognize, his consultant was like, I really think you should do more training. So off I trotted back to university, heavily pregnant with my third. Did a degree, started working at Southampton Hospital in allergy, and just found this career that I absolutely adore and that we're really passionate about as a family. So like our whole family bought into it. We run our own family business, Dr. Helen Allergy. The kids are often in clinic on the weekend playing with the other children. And, you know, we are one of the only centres to offer some life-changing treatment. And who knew that the journey we went on with Ethan would have led us here. And so now all of my children have sort of some allergic disease and myself and their dad. But at the time, this was a complete shock to us. We just weren't expecting it.
Gosh, it's just so fascinating hearing you say all of that. And I think, you know, the fact that you quite literally built a career out of it, but not only that, but you're actually, and we'll come on to this in a little bit, but your career is also changing things quite a lot, I feel like, in the allergy world. Yeah, that is really fascinating. And I kind of want to tap onto that a little bit more. But another thing I also wanted to ask is you mentioned about the breastfeeding. I know this is a very, very specific point, but you mentioned about breastfeeding, cutting out milk. Now, I think this is incredibly common for families who are going, oh gosh, I don't know what's wrong with my baby. I'm going to try a million different things. I hold my hand up. I did exactly this when my daughter was so unsettled and I had no idea what was wrong with her. Is, you know, cutting out allergens in your diet as a breastfeeding mum, does that actually help?
Well, it does if you have, and if the baby has an allergy to it. So there is a lot of dispute around, can you have reactions to things like cow's milk that pass into
breast milk
rather than if you're formula fed? And there is an allergist who's a really strong advocate that no, you can't. But
that's
most,
why I was asking.
Most other people don't agree with him. And it's quite difficult because many of us as allergists are going, well, it happened to us. And you know, I think it's really difficult to be told, no, it can't happen. Because, well, how do you explain that my son had an immediate reaction to it when it was given? And you hear that all the time. You know, I'm sure my child is reacting to, say, peanut via breast milk. Unusual, but I do think it probably happened. Gave it when we first introduced it and they had a stonking reaction. So something is going on.
Can I ask, how is that happening? Like what's going on in the breast milk? Is it that the milk contains the allergens? Quite literally, the allergens have been, you know, digested and absorbed in the body, and then the allergens are literally passing through into the breast milk. Yeah. Is that what we think is happening?
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. I mean, there are lots of studies looking at how much allergen, so say cow's milk, passes into breast milk. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the thoughts are that it probably really varies from woman to woman. Mm-hmm. But just like, you know, many babies, if you were going to give them a formula as an alternative to cow's milk because they're reacting, might tolerate an extensively hydrolyzed formula. Which has broken down cow's milk chains and varies from sort of 60 to 90% broken down. Lots of babies would be fine, but there'll be a proportion that will not and will need an amino acid formula where it's sort of completely broken down cow's milk.
Yeah.
And that's really what the thought is with breastfeeding, that most babies will be absolutely fine. And it's only when you give formula or at weaning, when you give cow's milk
really notice
that they'll have a problem. And therefore, if your baby is fine breastfeeding, you don't need to cut the foods out. But there will be a proportion of children who will react. But I think the biggest challenge I have is that many people sort of take this advice either off the internet or from well-meaning health professionals who seem to also blame lots of stuff on allergy these days. And then they've never put the food back to retry. So I see breastfeeding mums sometimes losing so much weight, so much out of their diet, like literally they're sat eating rice and chicken. Which is really not good for their long-term health or their immediate health. And you've got to question the nutritional content of the breast milk if you're not eating and the baby's still reacting because actually the problem is probably not allergy. It's something else like reflux or a sensitive tummy. And no one is helping these families find the way through because they actually get incredibly complex.
Yeah.
And breaking that down in a 10-minute GP consult when your knowledge is limited is just impossible.
I've never shared this before, but actually when I was breastfeeding Ada, and she was so unsettled. I was at my absolute lowest, like the lowest of the low. And I was like, I'm going to try everything. I tried everything. And I actually ended up cutting out a lot of food. And as a vegetarian myself, I ended up cutting out dairy and I cut out a lot of other foods. And I was not in a good way. I was not eating enough calories. I actually stopped producing milk at one point. And I remember my husband coming home and saying, you know what, you're not producing milk because you are not eating enough. And it was just so hard because I was just trying to fix her.
Yeah.
And even from my field and my knowledge, I still found it incredibly hard. So, you know, I totally get how people are doing this. And also I think when people are, you know, not getting the correct advice, they're kind of like willy-nilly trying it, aren't they? Like, let's just cut this out for a few days. Let's cut this out. Let's cut all these different things out at the same time. That's not a scientific experiment. It's not going to give you the results or the answers that you want.
No, and the thing is, if it doesn't help, put the food back in if you're then going to do another trial. But, you know, people just don't get that support that they need.
Completely.
Their mental health massively suffers. And I always sort of reflect back. So I breastfed Ethan, obviously, cut cow's milk. He got bigger and bigger. He was like on the 91st centile for weight. So again, leads the question of, well, he can't be allergic because he's growing.
Yes, there's another.
I got skinnier and skinnier. So I think I was like 7 stone. I am only small. So, and then, but the thing is that at that point, no one told me to make sure I had adequate calcium and vitamin D in my a supplementation because it needs to be high level calcium, more than your breastfeeding supplements. Yeah. Now, fast forward, you know, 16 years, obviously, unfortunately, been through cancer, had chemo, early menopause, all of that. But also now I've got osteopenia, so my bones are thin. And I attribute part of that to breastfeeding for over a year without adequate calcium. Yeah. So you so might not hard. See it in the moment. But now I'm suffering some of the consequences already at 44, you know.
And
this is why it's so important that all of our health professionals have adequate allergy training and that we have more dietitians and experts to refer our families to support. And they just don't get discharged at the off.
Because you and I are both healthcare professionals and we're here saying we had a really tricky time with this. We didn't know what to do. You know, your conversation about going to see the pharmacist and him kind of being surprised that you didn't have all the answers because you're a GP.
Yeah.
What on earth are parents supposed to do? Who don't have the scientific background, the healthcare professional qualifications. What on earth do they do? Because there isn't enough support available.
Well, you know what they do. They go online and they look for help from other well-meaning families or groups who've set up to support people. but the frustration, you know, I have with that is that was the advice given to you. Doesn't A, make it necessarily accurate, but it certainly doesn't make it applicable to that
somebody
person.
Else completely.
And when you're going for a proper healthcare, you know, appointment, particularly with someone like me who's a GP as well, you know, I'm going to be doing a rounded view of is this allergy, is this reflux, is this something more serious? But the whole point is you need a proper medical assessment, and that shouldn't be off face. But whilst, you know, I run my own groups, we will give you support and advice and tell you what to go back and ask and direct the conversation for. I do have problems with well-meaning influencers trying to set up groups when you're not a healthcare professional.
I just
find it staggering that people are buying into it. But the reason they're buying into it is desperation. And I get that.
So I'm jumping the gun here because I think that we started this off quite emotionally and intensely. But I'm jumping the gun with my questions here. But one thing I think would be really great to go now is what do parents do then? Let's say there has been an allergic reaction or they think their little one has got a reaction. Where should they go and what questions should they ask? Because this is my, you know, this is the key thing, isn't it? What we want is for parents to know in that moment, I know what to do right now. And I think most people have zero clue, like you and I.
Okay, so in terms of where to go, well, of course, your GP is your first port of call on the whole. Health visitors too, you know, in short supply again now. But some of the health visitors have received additional training. So sometimes, depending on who you
depending
see,
on who you get, this
they
is it.
May be knowledgeable. So I always say, A, go to the GP surgery and ask the receptionist who in the surgery is the kind of go-to person with eczema and allergies. That's a great starting point. And a good tip for anything that you need health, like who is the heart person?
Love
I would
that.
Say, who's the leg person? Not me. I was sick during university when legs were being done. Don't come to me. Might come to me for the allergies.
Don't know anything about legs.
Bear in mind that GPs are human beings, or any health professional you're seeing, frankly. They have 10 minutes. And also in that time, they're being pinged messages, they're overrunning, they're stressed because they've been on the phone to the hospitals. And so we want to do our best for you, but we also are sort of at the moment managing 60 to 80 patient contacts a day. So make it easy for us. I know, because I like to talk, that you want to share everything.
That's me too.
Be heard and tell every second. And then I went to the kitchen and then I got like, don't do that. You have 10 minutes. You want to focus. Write down your points. Write down a summary. They can scan it on your notes. That'll help them. Get a photograph album. Put all the relevant photos and poos and skin and whatever you want in that to really try and focus on using the first 4 to 5 minutes as your consultation time only so that the GP can, you know, create a plan and then move that forward in the last 4 to 5 minutes of what are they going to do next. And the sort of outcomes you're looking for, if this is an immediate reaction that gave hive, swelling, vomit, diarrhea, breathing problems, you know, you're most likely going to want a referral to an allergy clinic. There can be some exceptions with that. Egg allergies are not always referred, but you want to ask them about, do I need an allergy referral? Don't take the NHS doesn't do allergy testing as an answer. Absolute lie. Yes, we do in GP and in secondary care hospitals. So you know, push for, I think my child needs a referral. They have got allergy response. You know, I think they have allergies. And according to the NICE criteria, parental suspicion of allergy is a reason to refer to an allergy
clinic. That's good to know,
Sometimes, to be fair to GPs, hospitals push back from that and say no. And that's really difficult. But it is in the NICE guidelines. Also, don't forget the charities, Allergy UK, Anaphylaxis UK, loads of fact sheets to help you whilst you're waiting. But your GP could print you off an allergy action plan that talks about what are the reactions that might need an antihistamine. So hives, swelling, sneezing, congestion, itchy, runny eyes, vomit. And they can give you prescriptions for antihistamines if needed or buy over the counter. And what are the signs of anaphylaxis? So airway, breathing, circulation. So persistent coughing, that's the one that got me with my son. So it sounds like and it keeps going. Tongue swelling, voice change, breathing problems, floppy, not rousable, dizzy. Then they should be prescribing adrenaline auto-injectors.
So any of those symptoms are seen, we would be expecting,
we
hopefully.
That's the criteria. Prescribe two, teach you how to use them, give you a plan, make the referral.
In 4 minutes.
Exactly, you know, and also ideally teach you about May contains, how to read a label, how are you going to keep your child safe at nursery and schools? And so that is where patient groups are massively helpful. They've got those leaflets. Yes, some of the online groups are helpful for that, to teach you like what questions to ask at school. Just don't take your medical advice from them. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, got that, definitely.
The delayed non-IgE allergies are much more challenging. So they tend to occur in infants 2 to 72 hours later of reflux, vomiting, diarrhea, blood in the stool, lots of mucus. Some mucus can be normal, sometimes constipation, difficult to manage eczema. And if on the severe spectrum, weight issues, but normal weight can still equal allergy. So the NICE guidelines for that say the GP would advise you how to remove the food, trial it, see if things get better. Then you have to retry it to prove the diagnosis. Sadly, there's no test designed to recognize these ones. And at that point, when it's been proven, then NICE guidelines say refer to a dietitian. The challenge is they're few and far between. And sometimes that gets declined as well. But certainly like multiple foods out of the diet, they absolutely need that, you know, nutritional assessment. Are they getting the right? And I can't do that as a GP. That's why in my membership group, we have dietitians, because I don't know how to assess whether your iron level's correct, your calcium, your zinc. That's not, I didn't do a degree in that. And that's why really when you look at allergy, we need a team approach of a psychologist, a dietitian, nutritionist, a dermatologist, allergist.
To look
we
at it
need
all.
The whole picture. So that's
to just to summarize. So if you're going to the GP, write down everything you can. Remember, you've got about 4 minutes to convey what you're trying to convey. Leave another amount of time for them to answer you. You'll be looking for them asking about the different types of symptoms. If it's non-IgE, they will be ideally looking at how severe those symptoms are, referring on if needed. If it's IgE, then basically the same thing. Depending on the severity, they might give medication. Is that right?
So what could be useful is, let's say you're suspicious about peanuts. Write subtitle, peanuts. What did you see? How quickly did it come? And how long did it last? And what did you need to do about it? And do that for every food you're suspicious of with accompanying pictures. Because I will, in my histories, go through the same thing. You know, I'm trying to unpick and the kind of figure surrounding waffle, if you like. And I'm a waffler. And okay, you're telling me about, you think they've reacted to sesame. What did you see? When did that, how long after giving it did that happen?
So the all the details.
All the detail. Write it for us. Make it easy.
But then do, especially if it's severe, do expect follow-ups. So expect a little bit of advice and a little bit of guidance, but also do expect follow-ups. And in the meanwhile, there are some useful organisations like Allergy UK, Anaphylaxis UK, and BSACI as well. They have a really great fact sheet for parents, don't they?
BSACI, British Society of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, have some fact sheets that are useful around weaning. A lot of the stuff on there is probably more targeted towards health professionals. Obviously got Sadie Bristow Foundation as well. And also, if you're going to go online to like Instagram and Facebook, follow people like us who have got that scientific background. Take your advice from that.
For sure,
so rather than, I don't want to give any examples because I'll upset people, but like rather than Ted's mum who's got allergies, follow Dr. Such and Such, professional.
Who specialises in allergies. You know,
and I think the other thing I would say around that is be mindful of the origin of the doctor in terms of the country they practice in, because the practice in America is extremely different from the practice in the UK in terms of how we treat anaphylaxis and how we recognize it.
That's interesting.
But you will find a lot more allergists from America online. So you can get a lot of baseline information, but it's some different. Of it is slightly different. Same as the person online. If they live in Canada, the advice they've been told may not be the same advice we give. And also some of the things they get offered there is not, sadly, what we can offer here.
Not available necessarily.
So you just have to be mindful of who you're, who you're taking it
from. That's a really good point. Could you explain a little bit about IgE versus non-IgE and what we mean by those two different things? Because I think a lot of parents will benefit from that as well. Because I think many parents just think of allergy, whereas there are big differences, right?
Yeah, I mean, like looking back now when Ethan was like that young, I'd never heard of non-IgE. That's why I was like, okay, I'll take milk out. But I had no idea what I was looking for. So an allergy is an abnormal response from the immune system. So it's reacting abnormally to something that should be harmless, like grass pollen, tree pollen, peanuts, milk, whatever we're talking about. And IgE just refers to one of the types of immune cells, immunoglobulin E, which we all have in our body and was originally there and designed to fight off parasite infections. So if you measure all of our IgE, we'll all have some. And it can be high sometimes for no apparent reason. But if you have an IgE-mediated allergy, you will have IgE that specifically is shaped to recognize that allergen, thing you're allergic to. So for me, grass pollen and dust mite. So when that comes into my body, the IgE cell which recognizes that will attach itself to the dust mite and it will go along to cells called mast cells and release histamine and all the other chemicals. And you can measure that on a blood test or we can measure it on skin prick tests. And in a way, those diagnoses are straightforward because they give a classic history on the whole and you can test. Happy days. I mean, I sometimes wish in my clinic, please can someone just come with a straightforward like peanut allergy and I can, I know exactly what to do and how to treat it. So the non-IgE, as the name suggests, don't involve the immunoglobulin E, but we do know they still involve the you know, the immune system making it an allergy. And there are lots of subtypes of non-IgE forming, making it really complex. So I won't go into all of them, but things like FPIES, eosinophilic esophagitis, really tricky. And basically, they can't design a test because design a test, you need to find like some part in the pathway that's measurable. And they just, the scientists haven't figured that bit out. That's above me. So we have to do pattern recognition. So you're expecting usually multiple symptoms. But of course, as a GP or a parent, sometimes the first thing you'll begin to see is skin changes. Then leave it another week or two and then you start getting the reflux another week or so. And then you, so, you know, any health condition evolves. And sometimes as GPs, no, we're not going to diagnose it on appointment one because we need to see where's this going. So you're looking for the patterns and that's when we say, right, we're going to have to try removing the food for 2 to 4 weeks. Do the symptoms get better? Now you're going to hate me because I'm going to ask you to retry it, even if it's only, say, you know, 1 ounce of formula or mum's just having a latte, or I will say eat something you're desperate to eat because it might be the last time for 6 months or something. If the symptoms all come flooding back, the diagnosis is made. That can be tricky because sometimes you need a little bit of a few days before those symptoms start creeping back in.
And also sometimes you think there's a bit of psychology there where you're like, oh, is it, isn't it?
Oh,
it hasn't come back.
Trying
that's the trouble.
Trying to do it alone is. And then, you know, the same when we start reintroducing the foods further down the line with ladders. Suddenly you're driving yourself absolutely scatty of, is that
a reaction? Is that normal?
Is that, you know, the number of times I get some, you know, poo pictures and my kids are like eating like,
oh,
and I'm like,
God,
oh, it doesn't bother me. But, just the norm. You know, I'm just, you know, always the what is it? And Sod's Law determines that every time you retry something or you're going to do a ladder, the kid's going to get
unwell. Yeah, exactly.
And it just is. And so sometimes you have to do it multiple times to prove that you're doing something with the right for the right reasons.
Okay.
And the reason that matters, because some people say, well, why does it matter? We don't need dairy to live. True. But removing big food groups, we know has impairment, you know, can affect children's growth. And there's lots of studies showing that as soon as you start removing more than one food, their growth is at risk. Also, it's really expensive to be free from. And by eliminating food, sometimes we risk that they will convert to an immediate allergy. That's a big worry for me for children with eczema. And of course, the, you know, the growing up with A, your worry, but B, now children socially get excluded far too often because you can't have the cake or you can't have the chocolate or, and did your child even need this in the first place? And there's so many people wandering out around out there with the wrong label of allergies.
Yeah, completely.
So many.
Do you have any idea how many are like misdiagnosed? Do we have any data
on
that?
We have one study, which was the Europroval study. So it showed that around 25% of parents and caregivers reported that their children had a food allergy. And at that point, it was more like 2 to 3%. So when you unpick it based on the history, you could start saying, no, these don't. Add some more tests or food challenges and it cut it further. And the number of adults I see for like never been evaluated or like classic example, had several recently wanted to join the military. You can't join the military, unfortunately, if you have food allergy.
I did not know that.
I know. It's it's a really tricky area. Kind of, you feel like it's discriminatory. But I guess sometimes if you think about it from the military point of view,
the risk
in a war zone cannot guarantee that this hasn't got peanut milk.
Yeah, so true.
Egg,
you can't,
sesame,
you can't
whatever.
Keep it safe, essentially.
And you would put your comrades at risk if you now have anaphylaxis. Yeah. So it's just a strict line of no. It's really heartbreaking. Yeah. I do lots of military assessments. Mm. But I've had two recently where the GPs had relatively randomly put the label of peanut allergy across these person's records. Mm. One based on feeling a bit dodgy coming back from the pub.
Yeah.
And one based on they'd vomited once. And maybe mum had mentioned it. But, you know, both of these people were eating nuts every day. Mm. Crazily, one of the lovely people carried EpiPens around with him just because.
Well, even though he was eating them.
He didn't even have any allergies, bless him. But, you know, the military don't believe you. So we now have to do skin tests, blood tests, make them eat it to prove it to get them in.
I did not know that. Fascinating, genuinely.
Yeah, no,
That's a really good point. And I think I'm going to go back now to asking some of the questions. So one thing I wanted to ask is, and this is more of a practical thing, is there actually anything parents can do? Let's talk prior weaning. So breastfeeding, gestation, pre-weaning to actually prevent allergies happening.
Yeah, I mean, that was totally the question I had going to university, pregnant with my third, because, you know, my first and second had allergies and I was there every day going, what can I do?
Yeah.
And Gigi's 10 now. And actually at that point, it was moisturised from birth and that might help. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. And it was based off a small study. And I guess it does always show the importance of waiting for bigger trials sometimes before we leap. So actually what they did based on that small trial that looked like, maybe you should moisturise from day one.
The
bigger trial is called BEEP. Well, because we know, that's complex, but we know that children with eczema have higher risk of food allergies.
Yeah.
And the theory is that the reason they have higher risk of food allergies is that through their skin barrier that's not waterproof and tight, they're exposed to food over the skin. So in dust and dander and, you know, handling.
Yeah.
And so that's why sometimes children with eczema react the very first time you give them the food.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for others, if that hasn't happened, it might be the third, fourth, 20th time that they have a reaction.
Mm.
So it was felt that if you moisturise from day one, you're repairing that skin barrier potentially, preventing allergy forming.
Okay.
Ironically, Gigi was the one with the worst eczema, but is the one without food allergies. So I did that and she doesn't have any food allergies.
Mm.
She was incredibly rashy. But a bigger study came out called the BEEP study, which actually showed that you increase your child's risk of allergy by doing that.
Yeah.
And as you can think about it, because you're handling the food and you're eating and parents get the mums with the guilt. Like I'm like, you're allowed to eat and breastfeed or formula feed. You know, we have to eat, but the hard thing is that sometimes what you're eating is what the child's becoming allergic to because you're handling them because it is in the dust everywhere. Mm-hmm. So you'll often see that the mum that ate a lot of peanuts whilst breastfeeding and their child's got eczema is the child with the peanut allergy because it's in the dust.
Mm.
But what they're showed with the bigger study is that you were transferring the peanut protein across the skin by moisturizing.
Okay.
So just because it was, you know, you've eaten it, it's on your hands and it increased their risk of allergy.
Okay.
That's a backwards answer, isn't it?
Because so that's because you're moisturizing, but you're also eating all the allergens.
Yeah, and it's just...
So you're eating the allergens and when you're moisturizing, you're more likely to be transferring it to the skin.
Yeah.
But I mean, like you say, you can't really mitigate for that because...
No. But the point with that is... Only start moisturising if your child actually has eczema.
Okay, don't
wait
bother
for
doing
studies.
It. Got you, okay.
But when you do have to moisturise, when you do need to moisturise because your child's got eczema, wash your hands before and afterwards. And actually, we know that aggressively treating eczema, if it starts to show early, will help, we think, reduce the risk of allergies.
Okay.
So if your child is itchy and inflamed and red, then you do definitely need to moisturise, not with a food-based moisturiser like coconut oil, but with an eczema-specific one.
Mm-hmm.
Moisturise regularly, wash your hands before you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is going to create controversy, but get in there early, treat it with topical steroids, get that skin better and healed, and you will reduce their risk of allergy forming. And I cannot tell you the importance of acting quickly to heal the skin rather than worrying about the scaremongering online around steroid use.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are consequences and problems. There are with every single medication.
Yeah.
But they are rare. There are much bigger problems by leaving eczema untreated, not just because of allergy, but because of growth impairment.
Okay.
So treat eczema early.
Yeah.
But don't moisturise unless you need to.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Just sort of
no, that's good. Got it.
Um,
there is no evidence that what you do breastfeeding or in pregnancy in terms of what you eat makes a difference.
Okay. So it doesn't matter if you consume peanuts
No difference.
We used to think that.
It's clearly shown it makes no difference. It's all about babies needing to consume it early, which I'll come to in a sec.
Yeah.
There's a little bit around maybe having some fish oils as a pregnant mum, mm-hmm. really. The jury around probiotics is very much out. Mm-hmm. Can't really show it makes a difference, but it also doesn't harm. Yeah. Be aware it can make some people a bit bloated and gutty, mm-hmm. but if you want to do that, fine. Yeah. I'm personally a big advocate of eat the rainbow, have a really good nutritious diet and exercise.
Including
and
allergens.
Don't smoke, and including allergens. Yeah. And that is the best thing you can do.
Okay.
Beyond that, there is nothing you can do to prevent it happening.
Okay.
Apart from potentially early weaning.
Okay, got you.
All right.
And we'll come on to that.
I thought you might.
Honestly, it's fascinating. I'm learning. So I think one thing we need to really touch on now, what are the common allergens? And obviously this is really tricky as well, because, you know, I've had people write to me recently saying, you know, you're using lots of beans and legumes in your dishes, and actually that the incidence of allergies to those are on the increase, and everyone's recommending them more and more. So what are the common allergens in the UK that we need to look out for?
The commonest things we still see are like cow's milk, egg and peanut. Those are still really common. And then you've got the tree nuts. So people don't know, it's cashew, which is similar to pistachio, walnut, similar to pecan, almond, hazelnut, Brazil nut, macadamia, that we don't eat a lot of. Mm-hmm. I was asking my lovely son to help me with some online stuff. He was trying to find these blood results for peanut, and he was looking in the nuts section of the blood report. And I was like shouting at the stairs going, no, peanut's not a nut. And like, obviously the irony that he had those allergies. He was like, well, this is just absolutely ridiculous. And I was like, Ethan, coconut's not a nut either. Neither's nutmeg. And neither's butternut squash. Yeah. And he was like upstairs going, well, that's just crazy.
But yeah, love it.
So cow's milk, egg, peanut, tree nut, sesame. Mm-hmm. Fish, yes, a bit. I mean, it's not super, super common in terms of things I regularly see through the door.
Okay.
And you can be allergic to different type of fish. So white fish, salmon, tuna.
So you can have an allergy to one type.
You could just
rather
be allergic
than
to salmon and not the others.
Yeah, okay.
Shellfish, again, it is listed as the top allergens. Mm-hmm. It's not a common allergy of childhood.
Yeah.
Tends to occur more in adults. Okay. Wheat, again, a bit, not lot loads.
Mm-hmm.
Soya, I see that much more with the non-IgE than the immediate allergies.
Okay.
Those are the main ones. I think it's worth pointing out here that whilst on the label top 14 allergens, you will see sulfites.
Mm-hmm.
They are not really a true allergen, so thing that people are allergic to.
Okay.
So the thing with sulfites is they trigger for certain susceptible individuals, often adults, more reactions that look a bit like an allergic reaction and particularly trigger issues with their respiratory system.
Okay.
And because of the challenges of that, they're listed in as a main allergen.
Got you.
Because for people who've got sulfite intolerance and intolerances, an adverse reaction that doesn't involve the immune system, they need to avoid them.
Yeah.
But I have lots of families saying, oh, you know, what shall I try as sulfites to wean? You don't need to do that.
Lots of people ask me that.
Really
Okay.
Same with, you really don't need to give your kid squid. There's no evidence it prevents allergies.
Yeah.
So if you eat squid, fine. If you don't, you don't have to do it.
Okay.
And then around the legumes, we are definitely seeing much more pea, chickpea, lentil allergies. And I think part of that is around the consumption and the looking for alternative products as we become more plant-based, vegan, even the fact that we're dairy-free because of allergies a lot
more. Yeah, of course. So people are
looking for alternatives. And so you'll often find things like lentil flour, chickpea flour put in bread. And
so it's just a case that we're consuming them more.
That's what we're hypothesising.
Okay, got you.
A bit like, we really don't have rice allergies, particularly in the UK, but go to Japan and apparently they're really common.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like,
if someone came to me and said rice allergy, I'm pretty much going to go, I doubt it.
Unlikely, yeah.
But in Japan, apparently
but
very
we still
common.
Eat quite a lot of rice. I mean, obviously not the same, but
There's always, this is what I say to everyone, yes, there's bits we know, genetics, what you were eating, you know, breastfeeding. There's more to it than that, because the bulk of people that eat food whilst breastfeeding or formula feeding don't have a child with an allergy.
Yeah.
A lovely mum on the weekend, so upset about the fact her child had the lentil chickpea pea and completely blaming herself. And I was like,
why was she?
Because she ate it. She was vegan. I was like, but you have to eat.
Yeah.
But it's just, that's not the whole story. Mm. There'll be genetics in there too. There'll be the fact that there'll be eczema changes to the skin. And then there are other unknowns. But maybe I'm unique, but I didn't feel guilty about my children having food allergies because it's not my fault. And to be a bit flippant, what else were you going to do? Either be born or not born.
Yeah.
We all have some sort of inherent genetic risk.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing you can do about it.
You can't change that.
Yeah.
And guilt has to have a purpose. Francesca Soy, who I work with, who's our clinical psychologist, you know, she says guilt has to have a purpose.
Mm.
You can't feel guilty about something that you didn't do on purpose and that you can't change or modify.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So, but we do see more. And my colleague in Scotland says that they see so much lentil chickpea pea allergies up there.
Mm.
I'm so strange.
Yeah.
So I do wonder whether that will start to come through on the labelling in bold.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, the top 14 allergies have to go in bold.
Yeah.
I wonder if a change will come on that.
Okay.
I mean, the number of people I've had anaphylaxis to a Twister ice lolly that contains pea protein.
Really? Yeah. Gosh.
So they're looking for that, you know, alternative sometimes.
Mm. And yes, that's the trouble, though. I guess you could add more and more foods onto that list of bold, couldn't you, though? Because there's going to be,
I think the fundamental problem with labelling, and Anaphylaxis UK, who I'm a trustee for, did a business symposium last year. And part of that was around labelling. And they had an interesting neuroscientist talk about how we read and process. And basically, labels are just not set up for us to be able to read. And
to take in the information.
You get the parents coming in feeling guilty that I didn't notice the label, and because they're not designed for us to read.
Yeah.
You know, they're an absolute nightmare. They're better than they were, because when Ethan was little, it wasn't in bold.
Yeah, there was no bold.
Which is why
the
poor soul had so many reactions.
Yeah.
Because I'd scan and you'd miss whey or casein or some allusion to milk.
Exactly.
But it's still really challenging.
Definitely. Yeah. And on that note, where you mentioned about inheriting, are allergies inherited? And I think that's what a lot of parents want to know about.
Yeah, they are to some degree. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about that, we look at somebody's atopic risk. So atopy is a group of conditions. So eczema, environmental allergies, so your hay fever, dust allergies, animal allergies, asthma, and your food allergies. And so if as a parent you have something, your child's risk increases of atopy, not the same thing.
Yeah.
So all the time you hear like dad say, I've got peanut allergy, is my child more at risk? And the answer is not of peanut allergy, just of atopy.
Just of, okay.
So, I mean, I was quite allergic looking back at my mum. I will say the story, but now that she's listened to me talk so much on things like this, she's like, oh, you had an egg allergy. I mean, that's why you were vomiting and swollen.
Yeah.
And I was like, brilliant. But, you know, back in those days, they just kind of left out and retried. And thankfully, egg allergies often do resolve.
Yeah.
But I had egg allergy. I have some eczema, environmental allergies, and had asthma as a child. Their children's dad had environmental allergies and asthma. So we were already the perfect storm. Both of us doctors, both of us never once considering. I mean, but also, what would we have done? We'd have still had children. So Ethan has everything. And then Florence, in hindsight, had a delayed allergy. Did I even think about it? No. Miserable year. Miserable. Environmental allergies and eczema and GD eczema.
Okay.
So it doesn't mean
tracked.
Each child's going to get worse.
Yeah.
Typically, it's the firstborn boys most affected, but you'll always have families who will say, but my second has the 26 allergies.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, for me as a parent having more children, I was like, please just don't be allergic to anything different.
Let's keep
families
it
do
consistent.
Have that. And, wow, hats off to the families with the measures they take to adapt their lives, learn to cook. Be inventive and creative. They're phenomenal individuals.
Yeah. And we'll definitely come on to a little bit of that because I think that's a really important thing to ask. But one other thing I wanted to ask is, so in hindsight of all of this, if your little one is at risk of allergies and maybe mention what that actually means, would you be recommending testing before weaning begins?
Oh, 100% not.
Okay.
No, I'm really passionate about this.
Okay.
So
first of all, what is at risk?
Okay, so at risk. So, well, the genetics. So have you got parents and siblings with these types of things that makes you concerned? And also on that point, just to say, just because you don't have any atopy as a parent doesn't mean your child can't suddenly have allergy. And that's why there's more to the story. We don't know the whole picture. But parents or siblings with allergies or eczema, I'm going to be concerned. If the baby themselves has eczema, that is the key thing that's putting them at risk.
Okay, that's the key thing.
So those are my two things of, or if they've got other allergies, like a non-IgE allergy.
And that's because the allergen is going, they're being exposed to the allergen via the skin.
Yeah.
And why, can you explain a little bit about why that is problematic?
Well, we think that really the immune system then handles it as kind of a foreign body.
So because it's coming through the skin and they've got the broken skin barrier.
Rather than processing it through the gut, which is a more normal fashion.
Okay.
It's seeing it as basically almost like bacteria coming over the skin that they need to create a response against. Yeah. That's
and
the
and they would have, like you mentioned about the IgE, so they would have the, what did you call it? The receptor that then gets the allergen.
So
and
they'd
then
have
has,
the IgE measurable against, say, peanut. Mm-hmm. So you'd measure IgE to peanut and it might be raised so that when the peanut comes in, the IgE to catch it binds and travels off to the cell.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, the biggest issue with screening when someone hasn't eaten foods, and I get this request all the time.
Okay, got you.
Because of children
being
with
nervous.
Eczema is the biggest thing that families like, what's causing the eczema?
Mm-hmm.
Genetics, fundamental differences to the skin barrier. So children with eczema often have very high levels of total IgE, so the amount of immunoglobulin E cell in your body, and they can have lots of positives. That doesn't mean you're definitely allergic.
Okay.
We then fall into this pathway, particularly within the NHS, of going, oh, it's high.
Yeah.
They're probably going to react. Now, there will always be statistically some that don't. So the safest thing is probably avoid. And actually, that's probably not the safest thing because in the avoiding, allergy starts to form. So I would say, I know it sounds strange, but the safest time to give food is as a baby because babies are less likely to have very significant reactions. They're at risk from everything else, infection. They can have anaphylaxis.
But
if we look at the deaths
rare,
from
right?
a baby, there's been one in 20 years. And the baby had underlying respiratory issues as well.
So let me just reiterate that. So babies are a really good time to introduce allergens. They are less likely to have a severe reaction.
Yeah.
Anaphylaxis does happen,
it does
but
happen.
Often, but not often at all. And there's been one death in 20 years from a baby being allergic to a food and having an anaphylaxis reaction.
I can't say it's not often. It does happen.
Okay.
But I think the important thing about that conversation, 80% of episodes of anaphylaxis resolve without us giving adrenaline like EpiPens.
Yeah,
that happened to my son.
Mm-hmm.
And even when they do need adrenaline, if we look at all the deaths from all causes of anaphylaxis in the UK, so being what stings, medicines, food, it's around 20 to 30 a year. Now, if you statistically think about that, that's very hard to do objectively when you're the parent
of course,
worrying
absolutely.
Or the person with allergies. Everything else you do in life is more risky, but it doesn't stop you doing it.
Yeah.
So you can have your safety measures.
Yeah.
And the biggest safety measure is in a higher risk person like the child with eczema, start small. Just put a little bit on the inside of the lip, wait 20 minutes. Tip of a teaspoon, wait 20 minutes. Bit more, fine. Leave it that day. Come back to it. Gradually build up. Now, I know we've had this conversation before. You don't have to do that for every food. So I would usually say, the foods less likely to cause allergies are, on the whole, fruit and vegetables. Yes, you've got the odd pea and kiwi, but it's less likely. So I would wean normally. Oats, rice. I know there'll be people at home going, my child's got it. I know there's always exceptions,
there's
but this is just generalization. Oats, rice, meat, fruit and vegetables. So just wean normally with that. Because otherwise, if you do one food every three or four days, by the time you get to one, you're only going to have given like 40 foods.
Really,
and that is
going
to affect your gut.
Yeah.
And it's that that impacts on everything to do with your long-term health. So try and wean. And you can do several foods a day. You could do, if you're doing like the bigger allergies, like peanut, cashew, do peanut in the morning, cashew in the afternoon. Just leave a four-hour window. But let's say worst case scenario, because the majority of people are not listening to this. It's not on their radar. Sorry to break it to you. And they just, you know, maybe do baby-led weaning. So they're just making their own food and they give it to the baby. And that's a whole mix of lots of stuff. Your child has an allergic reaction. I'll figure it out. I'll do the testing if we need to. We'll do food challenges if we need to. So, you know, worst case scenario, it's hard to unpick it, but we can. But if you're nervous to start small,
And would you say that's the advice for those who are at risk? So starting off with these really small amounts of peanut and egg and milk. So you'd say offer small.
Yeah.
You know, you can offer it once a day along with other foods. You can offer it more if you want to, but leave a nice gap between different allergens. That's what your recommendation is. Because I know general allergy advice tends to be offer one food as the only new food that day, offer it in a tiny amount and leave a gap before offering another one, right?
Yeah. So the British Society of Allergy guidelines are for the early weaning, so from 17 weeks if you're at risk. And so they categorise that as actually quite significant eczema. It's a tricky, who diagnoses that?
Yeah.
So I do sort of extrapolate that to say if you've got eczema and the child has to be ready, so holding their head, lost their tantra.
All the signs of readiness.
Otherwise, you're going to have a really long, hard journey. If your child's not ready to eat, they're not ready to eat.
Yeah.
So wait till they're ready. Then I tend to do some veggies so that the first taste is not a reaction.
Yeah.
Then I would do peanut butter that you need to mix with some safe milk vegetables to make it less sticky. Then if you're going to very well-cooked hard-boiled eggs, then on the whole, I say, then wait till 6 months and then carry on your rest of your weaning journey. Unless the baby's super interested, because every child's different.
Yeah.
And there's no evidence that that's going to harm their gut by weaning at that age. For other children, it's from 6 months of age. In terms of the one allergen a day, it's not because you're causing harm. It really is because
it's
you're
just
trying
to try
to
and pinpoint
what's the issue. And as I go back to, we can test. The British Society of Allergy do say don't screen. So don't do all these allergy tests for a non-eating child. The other aspect to it, not only can they have false positives, they can have false negatives. So simply because a person's never eaten the food before, it looks fine. You're all reassured. Wonderful. And then 10, 20, 30 times later, at any point in the future, we can suddenly start to react to a food.
Okay. Yeah.
And I just go back to, I know it's traumatic because I have been there. So I think I'm allowed to say, I know that you're worried about anaphylaxis and how that actually feels. But we can't not feed our children. So isn't it better to know exactly what they need to avoid? Now, of course, there comes a point sometimes where if I have a family who've reacted to peanut and egg and sesame and wheat and milk, and they're like, I'm done. Of course I'm going to do more screening allergy tests and try and unpick it
and
with
try and
you
figure it out. Love that.
Because
yeah.
there comes a point where individual conversations have to happen.
Yeah.
Equally, if you're the parent and you've had such severe reactions yourself that you can't bring yourself to give your child the food and you're saying to me, I'm not going to do it otherwise. Of course, I'm all in for that.
What do you say? Because I have a lot of parents say that to me. So if you've got a reaction or a partner's got a reaction, what do you say? Would you say try and give it, or would you say?
Yeah, I do. Well, so there's some longer conversations that go on, but in terms of can the other parent or a friend or a grandparent or whatever give the food? Then there particularly has to be a conversation around if mum is breastfeeding, when is the right time to introduce that child to the food that mum's allergic to?
Yeah.
Because there's different studies showing how long it stays in saliva. It's likely to clear after an hour, but there have been some studies that shown it stayed in there longer.
Okay.
So for me, I go, yes, okay, let's say we've got a baby who's got eczema. So we know now their risk at peanut and mum's got peanut allergy. Okay, if your baby's still breastfeeding multiple times a day, we're going to have to go with safe. And that's not going to keep you safe by risking giving it to the baby.
Yeah, okay.
If your baby really does turn out to have a peanut allergy, and maybe that's happened because we didn't give it early, we had to wait till baby was one, I can figure it out with the treatments, which we'll talk about with immunotherapy. But we have to keep mum safe. The baby's going
to
be
so you still
no
need to prioritise that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if it's possible, we do want to try and introduce.
Yeah, we do.
And also, so you've mentioned about peanut and egg largely. Are you saying that these are the ones ideally we want to be introducing early and we want to be trying them in the diet nice and early? What's the rationale behind doing that?
Well, because there are different studies. So one's called the LEAP study and one's called the EAT study. And they did look at other allergens to see whether regular early consumption made a difference. And the answer was no.
Okay. So but it did with egg and peanut.
But it did with egg and peanut. Yeah. So peanut is the equivalent of a heaped teaspoon of peanut butter 3 times a week until they're 5. So what usually happens is they get fussy at 2 and parents put it off their radar. Don't do that, particularly if your child has eczema. Find a way to hide it. Grate peanuts down. Mix them in. If you mix peanuts in like savoury food or things like mint, it'll disguise the the flavour, taste, hide it. All the time we see reactions of children who tolerated it as toddlers, didn't have it, because that is life.
And then it was taken out,
And then they react. And we see that a lot with the bigger food groups. So you were eating milk, you've took it out. I know why, to try and make the eczema better. You've retried it again a year later, and now they've reacted.
An immediate reaction.
So please don't take food out of the diet without advice.
So and so that's it maintains the tolerance. So if you continue to offer it in the diet regularly, it helps to maintain a tolerance, which therefore reduces the risk of that allergy actually developing. And does it reduce the severity of allergies if you know?
Nothing can reduce the severity of allergy. And we can't predict what the severity of allergy is. Someone messaged me this morning and said, you know, do treatments help if you've got severe allergies? Like, the answer is everybody's allergy could potentially be severe. We can't predict it, and it can change from exposure to exposure.
Really, that's really interesting. That's so terrifying as well for parents, it is really, isn't scary. It?
Yeah. You know, Ethan's reactions were always relatively predictable. Hives, swelling, sometimes vomit. Yeah. That was what we always saw. And then one day it was anaphylaxis.
Yeah, exactly that. And then, and that's, I guess, why the immunotherapy is so important, but which we'll talk about. But I want to just really briefly talk about the maintaining and the continuing to offer it. Because this is definitely another question I get asked a lot. So it might be, for example, that they've introduced it or haven't thought about it. It might be the child's fussy. Yeah. It might be that, they like you said, they cut out the diet. What is the recommendation with trying to maintain it? And I'm talking about in all children, or is there a specific for children who are at risk? We really want to maintain it regularly. What should we be doing? And what happens if there is a time where it is cut out? Okay. And then they go to introduce. Sorry,
so,
that's really
specific. Fine. So I think we would say for all children, peanut 3 times a week. And that, you know, a lot of the studies are sort of more hypothesizing that if we did that on a population level, we would prevent, given that most people that present with peanut allergy don't necessarily have family history and they don't have eczema. And we couldn't predict it.
Okay.
So the study particularly looked at the high risk groups and we saw that if you regularly ate peanut, it reduced your risk from 35% to 10%.
Okay.
So sometimes despite your best efforts, allergy still forms.
It will still happen. But you're really reducing the risk if you offer that regularly.
Then for other foods, like it is hard. If you've got that child with eczema or the family history, if you've introduced things like sesame and tree nuts, try and keep them in once or twice a week. Okay. But there is no hard and fast because the data didn't support it.
Okay, got you.
But I think all of us as allergists would say, we see all the time that this kind of stopping and trying it later, particularly around foods like milk, egg, a little bit of the wheat, but less so. The peanut, the tree nuts, the sesame, those are the biggest things we see allergy form. Now, people will say to me, so does that mean if I give prawns, I've now got to give that every week? And I would say, no, it doesn't seem to happen for everything. Because you know, you can't get obsessive about today's the day we're all eating
also if you did all the allergens twice a week, you run out of meals.
You can't. It just feels like it's something around the peanut, tree nut, sesame.
Milk, peanut, egg, tree nut, sesame, egg, milk, wheat. So if you try and introduce those and try and keep them regularly as you can during weaning, and especially if your little one's at risk, and especially I think you're saying with egg, peanut and milk. Okay.
Now, let's say you're the family who are sitting now listening going, oh, no, we fell into the trap. And we took it out because we thought it might make the eczema better. Now what we do? So don't panic. Again, you can only do the best you were doing at the time with the information you had. And you have to remember that you're doing this because you're trying to help your child, not because you were trying to cause an allergy. So if it's happened, please don't beat yourself up about it. But let's say your child has rip-roaring eczema. You took the cow's milk out. You've realized it didn't make a difference. What do I do now? Start small. A little bit of a rub on the inside lip. Little sip. Build it up slowly. Or if you're really worried about things like the milk and the egg, start with it baked. So if you bake those in a wheat matrix, so you give a biscuit or you give a cake, the protein is more broken down and they're less likely to react, but build it up relatively quickly. But don't delay it. Start again.
So you'd say at home, do it again. Small amount. Bake it if you can. Okay. And what about for fussy eaters? Because that's what I was going to ask. Any tips for getting some of those foods in for fussy eaters?
Yeah, because it's hard, isn't it? You know, really we're sitting here talking about like the ideal parenting, but let's all be real. Like, you know, especially if you've got more than one kid, you're all running around like crazy banshees and, you know, I can't say I'm the parent who made sure every child sat there and ate peanut. I didn't. I can only tell you this is what I would
this
say
is
to
what
do.
We'd recommend.
Don't watch what I do. So fussy eating is really difficult because, you know, toddlers are extraordinarily strong-willed.
Yeah,
you're not winning. And actually, with the treatments we offer, they're a really difficult group to do. So, you know, can you work with them? We have a speech and language therapist, Julia, who works with us, and she's wonderful. And she actually talks about how you can use ChatGPT to write social stories for children. So she says, write a social story to explain to a three-year-old why it's really important to keep peanut in our diet because of, you know, allergies. So you could use like that, make your own picture
little
books.
Stories.
I always used to read to my children, like the book would be about whatever, and I would just change the words because while I can't read, I just made it up. Saying, and today, little Ethan's really tired and he'd love to go to bed for his mummy and sleep and not make her sing 20 songs.
Yeah.
You know, and he would think it was hilarious and not sleep. But anyway, they, you know, but using stories helps sort of helps them. And then there's the, you know, sticker charts and the rewards.
Yeah,
can you
but also hiding. I think
and
you mentioned hiding. We normally obviously don't recommend hiding foods for fussy eating, but in the allergy situation, if you're trying to get them in for a purpose, you know, stirring peanut butter into something, you know, yogurt that's almost unnoticeable, or, you know, throwing, I'm trying to think, or like even sesame, like stirring a bit of sesame into a dinner and they're not going to notice it. It's for
a
reason.
We do hide foods for the good of our children, don't we? Yeah. We are not all blitzed down, you know, courgettes and put them in your bottle. Because you need to child to eat some vegetables because we are parents and we need to behave that way for them. So, but you know, peanuts and nuts and things have a really strong flavour. But like I say, actually masking it. So if you put it with like chocolate, you'll make it worse. But that's why we have chocolate nuts because they're really tasty. But if you want to mask the flavour, you're better putting in savoury, ice cream, mint, orange flavours. So grinding it down, can you put it in a smoothie and blitz it up? So you have to look at what's your child's diet. And if you've got particularly restricted feeding, sometimes you're going to have to go with, this is going to be too challenging. Work with your dietitian or whoever you're working with. But otherwise, you know, be inventive and hide it.
Exactly.
And get them to cook with you and show them like why this is so important and explain about allergies so that our children grow up being aware of these things.
Exactly. And I imagine that's a really important thing for a lot of families, isn't it? To talk to them about their allergies.
Yeah.
Okay, so if a parent is weaning and they suspect an allergy has happened right here and now, can you explain what their steps should be next?
Like literally as we speak, they're watching this.
They're watching a reaction. And it might be good to talk. I know you have mentioned them, but just talk briefly. The two kind of different sets of reactions. And then what do we do right there?
Well, I mean, the more immediate life-threatening one is the immediate IgE-mediated allergy. So it quite often will happen whilst they're sat at the table at the high chair eating. You'll turn your back for a second and you'll turn around and you'll be like, whoa. And, you know, you can have incredible facial swelling, which looks totally disfiguring. And just before we did this, I was showing you how I keep randomly getting that. It's not from allergies, but it can happen randomly. And you can look really disfigured. And if your lips are really swollen, you're going to freak out that the next thing that's going to go is the tongue. And I just want to give a level of reassurance of that actually isn't very common.
Okay.
So you can look like you're covered in hives and swollen. We need to act, but have that reassurance of Dr. Helen says this is going to get better. So what do you want to do? Well, don't put them in a hot bath or shower. It makes the reactions worse. Yeah. Moving about and lots of exercise
makes the reaction worse. Don't send them outside to run laps around the house.
Makes them worse. So wipe it off the food where it's made contact. And if you've got some antihistamine in the house, give it. And if you haven't, you
know, how do you give that to a baby? Out of curiosity.
Syringe.
Okay.
Yeah. So a bit like how you give Calpol, really. Yeah. So that all antihistamines are off license under one, but we do use Pyriton. It's been used very safely. Personally, I use cetirizine, which is licensed from two.
Okay.
It's not licensed, but it's safe, long-acting, less side effects.
Okay.
But you will need a prescription for an under one.
Yeah.
And then for others, you can buy it over the counter. So you sometimes can ring the GP. They might, you know, manage to see you urgently and sort that out for you. 111, 999 if you're worried.
Yeah. So 999 in what situation?
Well, the usual situation would be those signs of anaphylaxis. So ABC, persistent coughing, the voice has gone croaky or absent, the tongue is swollen. As I say, that's not super common. Breathing problems. So you can see they're rapidly breathing. It sounds noisy. They're grunty, floppy, or an older person feels dizzy, chest pains, don't feel well. If they're old enough to follow instructions, sit them up. If they've got breathing problems, if not, lay down and lift their legs. Ring 999 and say the word anaphylaxis, and it's that which prompts an urgent response to you. and don't move around until the ambulance get there and move you out.
Yeah.
If it's the milder symptoms, to be honest, they will often self-resolve. So don't panic you haven't got antihistamines in the house. I always explain, look, it's a bit like you're giving your paracetamol because you've got a headache. Mm-hmm. It doesn't fix the reason you had the headache in the first place. It just treats the symptoms.
Immediate symptoms,
So it will get rid of the swelling and the hives for you. Mm-hmm. But even if you didn't, the body will naturally resolve it, usually within an hour or two.
Okay.
And the other myth that exists of, if I don't give antihistamines, it will progress to anaphylaxis. Mm-hmm. No, if it's going to progress to anaphylaxis, it's going to progress regardless of what you do. Antihistamines don't stop that.
Okay, that's interesting.
And I do find healthcare can be really unhelpful of like, oh, you know, next time it'll be worse. Not true. Mm-hmm. It might be completely different again. Or moments later and they would have died. Also, utterly unhelpful statement that families have to go around living with. And not true.
So they're saying moments later, if you hadn't treated, they might,
they do, because they don't understand it. I mean, they don't. If you come to my allergy clinics, I am running around like a headless chicken because we're treating lots of children and I'm juggling. But actually, it's not because I'm really stressing out that they're having allergic reactions, which do happen from food challenges and things, because they do often resolve. It's really hard to hear that, and you can have severe. So I don't want to make people feel sort of gaslighted that these can't be really severe reactions. Yeah. They can be, but most of them resolve. So just to calm, you can, you've got to be the swan. You're stressing inside, I get it.
Yeah.
But, you know, find a way to get antihistamines if you want, or just keep them cool, calm them down.
Yeah.
Watch for the anaphylaxis symptoms. If they happen, you're straight on the phone to an ambulance.
Yeah, got you. And also, with if they aren't that serious and you've calmed and they just disappeared, are we still...
Then go and see a GP.
Go and see a GP.
Yeah, and not as an urgent that day.
Yeah.
Obviously, avoid that food, book an appointment, avoid go and discuss.
And ask to speak to someone who knows more about allergy. Okay, brilliant. So, right, that's really helpful because I think a lot of parents definitely need to know that. What then happens also if you do have a diagnosis? So what I wanted to ask you was a bit more about living with allergies. I mean, you obviously are absolutely the expert because you've, as you said, your entire family have some kind of form of allergy, but also you are an expert. You work with allergy patients every single day.
Yeah.
What are your, I guess, go-to advice for families who are going, oh my gosh, we've got an allergy. How do we live like this?
Yeah. So I did a bit on this the other day. So I think the first thing is allowing yourself space to feel upset about that.
Mm-hmm.
That like, because none of us want our children to have anything. Mm. That's the reality. We don't want them to feel upset. We don't want them to feel hurt. We don't want them to think that they have to live a different life.
Mm.
And your brain will start going to places that, especially I'm afraid as a mum, like, oh my goodness, what about the first time they're out and they're going to kiss someone? I mean, you know, you're talking about an 8-month old.
Mm.
So allow it, but then come back in the room and try and be more practical about and you know, our strap line of our business is live well with allergies, because when it happened to Ethan, there were two things, that big things that happened to us. First of all, of course, he was on intensive care and he was very sick when he was born, and I made a sort of pact to myself, if I don't want to be the parent that is forever saying, oh, my child's got weak lungs, because we're still gonna have a good life here. And then the allergies happen and I'm like, okay, but I still want us to do what we always planned for him. Now, if you're a family that stay at home, fine. But we were a family that traveled the world.
Yeah.
And that was what I wanted to make sure happened. So it's then, what measures do I put in place to make sure my child's going to have the life I wanted, albeit looking slightly different.
Yeah.
And that means a lot of planning.
Okay.
So, you know, you need to be thinking ahead of, well, if we're going on holiday, you know, what sort of holiday are we going to self-cater or are we going to go to a hotel? Get some advice. Who's a good, you know, place to go? There's just a lot more prep in it, but it's 100% doable. We went to Thailand. We've been to Dubai. Yeah. We went to Europe.
Mm.
Yes, he had reactions sometimes in those places. Mm-hmm. They were all still managed.
Mm-hmm.
The memories we hold are not really the memories of the reaction.
Yeah.
They're the memories of like, holiday, you know, in Dubai, people kept taking my children off to kiss them because they were all blonde and white and they liked that, you know, came out with kiss marks and I wondered where they'd been. So, you know, those are the memories you want to be creating, your normal childhood memories, and knowing that everything else within that is doable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the support groups are really useful. Yeah. So get your sheets. Okay, well, what conversations do I need to have at nursery?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whenever you do a nursery, you're going to go around and there are things that you were looking for and they were maybe like, you know, what's the staff ratio? How many times do they spend with the children? Is it an outdoor school? The sorts of things you wanted as a family.
Yeah.
Now you're adding in that. And what are your policies on allergy?
And
do I get a feel that you have a clue what you're talking about here or not? Do you have other children here with allergies?
Yeah.
as an extra load, there's definitely a burden to it, but it is completely you can navigate it.
Yeah. And what about like living at home with allergies? I mean, I often share things like, you know, separate cupboards for keeping allergy foods so that your child knows where to go to, or, you know, also having conversations with them about it so they grow up being able to just quite literally ask somebody, does that have peanut in it, for example, being really aware of what to do. I guess things like carrying EpiPen and any other kind of like tips like that would help.
Yeah, I think the conversations are really important.
Yeah.
You know, I often get people reach out and say, what point do I start telling them about an allergy? And you're like, these should just speak to me, like as a doctor. The sorts of conversations like how do you make a baby that you just naturally talk about these things and don't make them into a big deal.
Yeah.
And then they're not.
Yeah.
You know, child appropriate, you're not going to talk about really severe, and you're just going to be talking about, you know, and again, I go back to ChatGPT, or there's some good children's books. Start bringing them into conversation. Mm-hmm. The other way I really like doing it is lots of play of doctors and nurses so that they get used to those settings. Mm-hmm. Play, you know, skin prick tests and pop the bubbles. You can make your own kit at home. Play shopping. You know, oh, this is the packet. Beep, mummy, just check, has it got whatever you're allergic, you know, peas, peanuts, in it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Not that one. That one makes you poorly.
Yeah, love that.
Child friendly, but, you know, role play is absolutely the way to do it. And you will hear them do it. I mean, the number of parents that say to me, oh, their children were playing Dr. Helen. And I love that. You know, I've got these children around the world who are like, not around the UK, brilliant. But Dr. Helen. So, yeah, role play is really important. Yes, while the child is too young to understand the grabbing, then make sure that the accessible snacks are, you know, a bit like don't put your hot cup of tea on the side.
Where
are you going to put those foods? You've got to make a decision as a family of, are we going to take the allergens out of the house or not?
Yeah, of course.
My personal feel for most, but, you know, you all make your own choices because we are our own individuals.
Yeah,
we'll have our own stories. Yeah. I didn't want to, and I do sometimes feel that when they're completely excluded, the anxiety can be much higher. You know, particularly things like peanut have got a very strong smell. Children will say, I've sat by and me open peanuts and I had a reaction. And a lot of that can sometimes be the worry, and it triggers your immune system because of the worry. So if they're used to having them around the house, but they're not touching that, that's the sisters or whatever, because you've also got to think about the siblings. I find that an easier way to live. But of course, if you've had a child who has reacted at ridiculously tiny amounts or very severe, you're going to probably follow a different path.
So it's situational,
it's
basically.
It's situational. Yeah. And that's why we can't judge what someone else does, because we're not walking in their shoes.
I imagine you've got a lot of families who are incredibly anxious and over-worried. And do you have anything you say to them?
I mean, I think I say, you know, this is totally doable. They're going to have a good life. And we can live well with it. But it's okay that you feel like this.
Yeah.
But we also need to put measures into place.
Yeah.
Because you're their role model. So if you don't eat out and you don't go on holiday, now your child is 20, 18, 16, not got a clue. How do I advocate for myself in a restaurant?
Yeah.
So you start small, start with the trusted place, ask for the recommendations. But you do need to model. We can't just lock ourselves away.
And like you say, keep living well still. I think that's a really good way of thinking about it. But like you say, takes more planning, takes more prepping, takes more thought, but you still can live a normal, happy life.
Soft plays are a bit of a nightmare, but we still went. We went to parties. We took our own, you know, snacks. You know, people often talk about the like high quality goods. So if somebody else is having an ice cream, and now you can't have an ice cream because you've got a dairy allergy, what's your high quality snack that you've got in the bag? But you know, also the reality is disappointment is a normal
I'm trying to teach my kids that at the moment.
And you know, Ethan is a very well adjusted 16 year old. He actually has great relationships with food, whereas my little one is half chicken nugget. I mean, she's a nightmare. But learning, and it teaches them empathy for other people. He's incredibly intuitive about feelings. And I do think allergy children become very like that. They learn. So you can't, you know, someone said to me when I was going through a divorce, you can't protect your children from all of those emotions. They are allowed to cry and be upset and feel hurt. What you have to teach them is, and role model, it's okay that you feel sad. You're allowed to cry. And how do we manage those situations? Because all of us in life have hurdles. So if you're protecting your child from every hurdle, then they won't, you know, be well-rounded mm-hmm. adults, mm-hmm. knowing what to do when life mm-hmm. gets tough.
Yeah, that's so, so important. I love all those messages. So lastly, I really want you to tell me a little bit about the immunotherapy that you do. Yeah. You know, I find it fascinating. I don't know anywhere, you know, near enough about it that I should know. So do spill.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely love this area.
Yeah.
Had no idea that this is the path that I would end up being something quite cutting edge. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a sort of person who likes to read research. Actually, mm-hmm. I like to hear it, yeah. assimilate it, and then share mm-hmm. it. But this is the one thing that gets me reading mm-hmm. papers. So immunotherapy is designed for those immediate IgE-mediated yeah. allergies. And the concept of it is that we are giving that person small bits of what they're allergic to mm-hmm. in a very controlled manner. Mm-hmm. They eat it daily if mm-hmm. we're talking about oral immunotherapy. Mm-hmm. And then every 2 to 4 weeks or mm-hmm. so, we will increase the amount. Mm-hmm. And over a period of time, we get them to be able to tolerate higher levels of the food that they're allergic to. They still, on the whole, have their allergy. Mm-hmm. And so if you tip the balance by going way above that amount, they might still react. Mm-hmm. But generally what happens, let's give peanuts an example. We gradually build them up to be able to eat 1.5, 2 peanuts.
Okay.
That's how most of us do it in the UK. And then after a year, the likelihood is their threshold's actually raised from here 2 peanuts to here 20, okay. 25 peanuts.
Okay.
They can wow. choose to incorporate it in their diet, but there's lots of rules around it. They have to try to mitigate the risk of anaphylaxis from mm-hmm. eating that food daily by not having it if they're sick, not running yeah. around for 2 hours.
Got you, yeah.
Carrying your EpiPens, caution. So there's mm-hmm. lots of rules around it. Mm-hmm. But it's something that we've been doing now mm-hmm. for, well, 3 years with peanut and a year for all other food, mm-hmm. all other, but lots of other foods, so sesame, tree nuts, milk, egg. So the other newer, very exciting form of immunotherapy, I think, is called sublingual immunotherapy. Mm-hmm. So this is the concept where you put, say, diluted something under your tongue, mm-hmm. cow's milk, please always with like guidance, and hold for a minute and then swallow. Mm-hmm. And what the research on that is showing that is, although it's a much slower approach, because rather than say, if I was treating peanuts within 4 months, I could get you eating 1.5. Mm-hmm. This is a long-term gain. But one of the studies with peanut particularly showed that after 4 years, 89% of them passed peanut challenges mm-hmm. just from holding a very small 4 milligram amount under their tongue.
Okay.
And the risks from that treatment are much lower. So the risk of anaphylaxis is much, much, much lower.
But did you say hold it under the tongue and then swallow?
And then swallow.
And then swallow, okay.
Yeah. So we've done sublingual immunotherapy for years in the UK for grass pollen, tree pollen, dust mite, pets even. We do venom immunotherapy to treat bee and wasp stings. So the concept of immunotherapy is not new. Mm-hmm. We have Palforzia, that's the licensed product for peanut.
Okay.
Very expensive, has got nice approval, barely anyone offers it on the NHS. These are really time-consuming things. And in a service that is in crisis, because we can't assess all these people with allergies, that's why you're not finding it. And so it is hard, because this basically at the moment is something that you have to have some money to afford to do. We are looking at some ways. I'm trying to change some bits of it. But the point is, we need to even be having these conversations and bringing it through. So just got back from America, where we were learning what the American allergist did. They've done it 15 years ago. What gets me is immunotherapy
wow.
for food.
Yeah.
10 years ago, I was at university doing an allergy master's. There was not even a lecture on it. I'm so cross about it for people who's now adults or teenagers, and we can do it for them, but it's much harder. Whereas the data coming through looks like if we do it for your child when they're under 3, we might actually get rid of their allergy altogether.
Okay.
But it's certainly going to raise
And what is it? Is it the, it's the building up a tolerance just bit by bit by bit. That's essentially what immunotherapy is, right?
I say it's not rocket science. It's got lots of rules.
Of course,
there's a massive art to it, I would say. You know, as I say, I've been doing it now for 3 years. There's a huge art of, do you dose today? Do you miss today? How do you tweak it? What are the medications? Because if you have a straightforward journey, you can get to the end and go, they're even allergic. But for some, there are lots of hurdles. You need that full wraparound psychological support that we have. You need the dietitian support to help with the how do you eat it. You know, if you have a child with feeding difficulties, neurodiversity, maybe real food immunotherapy is not going to be their thing. And that, you know, you might make their lives much worse by doing it.
Because it's a long, can be a long process, right?
Well, you're trying to get them to eat the food every day, you know, and we all talk about don't force your children to eat. But with immunotherapy, you have to eat the dose every day. Otherwise, you'll lose your built up tolerance. Sublingual immunotherapy won't bring that. But I think whilst this is fascinating, I could literally sit here and talk for like 2 hours about immunotherapy because I love it.
I think what it also does, though, is it brings this added burden to the allergy patient, community, family, yeah. and adults too, like are reaching out to me going, you know, there isn't this treatment for adults. Mm. We actually are about to offer it for adults.
Oh, wow.
But it's this burden that you have to have some money to do it. And that's, you know, not, yeah, we are in financially difficult times.
Yeah.
You may know in the heart of hearts that either this is going to bring too much anxiety for you or your child, or they've got, you know, restricted feeding patterns.
Anyway,
you're feeling pressured. You want to do the best by them and you can't really give them this option. So now we've given this, here's like a potential treatment and here's this whole other burden to cope with it. And no, we can't offer you on the NHS.
Yeah.
So it's just like it's got loads of mixed emotions with it. But to have options for our allergy families and patients is incredible. And there's lots of work being done on it. And, you know, I was really happy to take some colleagues with me to Texas to bring them to learn about it.
Love that.
So I think watch this.
Are we learning more from America as well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, 100%. Massively. I mean, some of the stuff they said over there, we were all like going, oh, do we agree with that?
No.
But, you know, how you treat food allergies, they're way ahead of the times.
Okay, that's ridiculous. Amazing. Yeah.
You know, and I think it's change is coming in the UK.
Okay,
slowly.
That's really good to know.
It's coming.
And in order to get that support, would it need to be like a one-to-one when they need to see you face-to-face for immunotherapy?
Good question. We do some bits remotely. The sublingual immunotherapy needs one appointment face-to-face.
Okay. But you can also do it remotely.
You can do it remotely.
So, right, now I just last thing, resources.
Yeah.
Where do people go? We've mentioned Anaphylaxis UK. We've mentioned Allergy UK.
Yeah.
We are, you know, also tell them about how to access your information. But any resources, books, worksheets, websites, can you just refer parents so that they've got somewhere else to go?
Yeah, I mean,
this.
Ask your clinics what they've got. Some of them have made like fact sheets local to your area. Some of them, like we've got Wessex Healthier Together, which actually has gone a bit more nationwide, which is a great children's site. Or it's for parents, but lots of information and fact sheets about navigating milk allergy, egg allergy. You will find some useful resources from families online. But, you know, just today I was like saying, well, that's not quite true. So it is really tricky. I would prefer you to stick to either sort of some of the NHS provisions, the British Society of Allergy, say the Bristow Foundation, Allergy UK and Anaphylaxis UK for the facts.
Yep.
And, you know, yes, there are some additional NHS type resources that you'll find within it.
Yeah.
But they're good starting points because they'll link within their fact sheets where else to look on this topic.
Of course.
The British Dietetic Association, that's another good one as well.
And what about you? Tell us how to find you.
So I'm known online as Dr. Helen Allergy. No, that's not my surname.
I know. Do you know what? I always like, hold on a minute. What is her surname? Because
no,
I just call you know, Dr. Helen Allergy.
Yeah, exactly. My friend said, like, you're now like Madonna. You have no surname.
Yes, you have no surname.
It's because my surname is double-barreled. It's Evans-Howells. So my GP job of visiting the elderly, none of them could get that. So I just went, just call me Dr. Helen.
Just Dr. Helen.
I now refer to myself as Dr. Helen, which is like this totally egotistical thing to do. I like at home go, well, Dr. Helen says wash up, like I'm talking to my children, like, I've gone mad. Anyway, so I'm on Instagram, Facebook, we have an allergy support group with Dr. Helen Allergy. If you literally Google it, you'll find it, and lots of resources and podcasts and things that we've done.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And you're doing such an incredible job, so please check out what Helen's doing. And if you have a child with allergy, there is help.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for being here. I've loved it. You've been fascinating. And I could talk to you for hours and hours more. And I might do. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you so much to Dr. Helen for joining me today and sharing truly incredible insight, as well as her personal experiences with dealing with allergies and handling them at home. If you enjoyed today's episode, please do subscribe, share it with a friend, or leave a quick review, as it really does make a massive difference. This podcast is brought to you with support from Little Dish, so a huge thank you to them for hosting us in their headquarters. And finally, make sure you stay tuned for my next episode. This episode of How to Feed wouldn't have been possible without my sponsors, Little Dish. Their meals are fresh, delicious, and made with ingredients that you would find in your own kitchen, making them a brilliant option for busy days.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.